Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is Introduction to Web Server Debugging in IBM HTTP Server. Today's presenters are Harold Fanning and Jim Eberwein. Harold's 30-year career spans several products like the DPPX operating system, 17 years in development for communication server products, including OS2 and Windows. Since being in customer support, he has supported personal communications, host access transformating, the AST Toolkit, IHS Web Server, WebSphere plugin, and WebCH products, including the load balancer and caching proxy. Jim is a senior software engineer in IBM Software Group, North Carolina. He joined IBM in September 1986 and has performed numerous roles at IBM, primarily providing technical support for various IBM software products. Jim currently supports the IBM HTTP server and the IBM WebSphere plugin products. At this point in time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Harold and Jim.
Thanks, Joseph. This is Jim Eberwein. Welcome to the IBM HTTP Server for WebSphere Application Server debugging session. Throughout this presentation, references to IBM HTTP Server for WebSphere Application Server, I'm going to shorten that to either IBM HTTP Server or IHS. Let's move to slide two. Our goal today is to introduce basic debugging practices to the web administrators who are responsible for managing IHS. Our focus will begin with a brief overview of the IBM HTTP Server product. Next, we're going to turn our attention to the various subcomponents of the product that web administrators will typically reach out to the IBM Support Center for assistance when they encounter a problem. So our goal is to allow you to resolve your problems before you have to open up your PMR. Examples of these subcomponents are security, SSL, the WebSphere application server plugin, various HTTP status codes, web server hangs, system performance, load balancing, and some of the general administration issues that you get with IHS. It's also important for web administrators to understand their topology of their system, as the web server is just going to be one possible point of failure. And a lot of times we run into problems that are outside of IHS, but they can be, you know, viewed as a problem with the web server. So we want to look at those as well. Moving on to slide three. IHS is included with WebSphere Application Server. It's based off of Apache 2.0 or 2.2, depending on the version release of IHS and WebSphere, and it provides a rich set of Apache features in addition to IBM enhancements. If you're familiar already with Apache, then it should not take much time to understand the features of IHS. IBM also packages a free downloadable version of IHS. However, support for that package must be purchased separately. The version that comes with WebSphere Application Server has some caveats on what is supported, as not all features provided with Apache are supported by IBM. Our information center has a complete list of the Apache libraries, modules, and directives that are supported by IHS. One example of something that's not supported are CGI scripts. They're not supported within the scope of the support that IBM is going to provide. To determine the version of Apache web server associated with the version of IHS that you have installed, one of the startup parameters is the dash uppercase V. You can include that on the Apache ECTL or the Apache commands that you use to invoke IHS. And that will just spit out the output, including the version number of Apache. Administrators of IHS, the administration is primarily performed by configuration of a configuration file called httpd.conf. Since the WebSphere plugin will play a pivotal role in the distribution of these HTTP requests handled by the web server administrator should also be familiar with that file, although they're typically not going to edit it through a standard editor. Instead, they're going to maintain it through the WebSphere admin console. Error logging and product tracing are typically the first areas you're going to look at to investigate when you're diagnosing a problem. For issues with IHS, there's the access log, the error log, and the plugin log. Those are the primary files you're going to use to investigate the problem. Moving on to slide 4. Before you dive deeper into these log files, it's always a good idea to review the obvious. First, you want to make sure that IHS is currently running and listening to the desired ports. If the product splash screen can't be displayed or the netstat command shows that those ports are not listening, then you can use the startup parameter dash E, and that's a lowercase e. And that's going to allow you to see if there's any startup errors that are preventing IHS from serving requests. Additionally, there's the minus T parameter. That can be used to perform a syntax check against your config file. This syntax check is a little more advanced than just checking the contents of the file. It's also going to make sure that your environment is suitable for starting IHS. I'm just going to check your directories out there to see that the module statements are valid. There's other commands that you want to check to see if the server is available. For example, telnet, nslookup, and ping. You actually also want to make sure that your server box has network access. We've seen PMRs in the past where, you know, a machine may not even have network access. It could have a bad network cable, for example, and that would stop, you know, IHS from running for sure. Let's move on to slide 5. Looking at the access log, that's where you're going to see a summary of all the requests that are passed to the web server. The location and content of the access log are controlled by a directive in your config file called custom log. It works in combination with the log format directive, which will allow you as the administrator to control the content and format of the data that is actually written to the log. Information that we deem critical is for sure the URI request and the response code and the timestamp. So those are the three things we really want to see in the log file. It's very common to scan the file for these response codes to see if there's any in the range of 400 to 500, which are typically the errors that we're going to see in the support center and the ones that we look to investigate. Now, the size of the access log is going to grow really quickly. We strongly encourage you to modify the default directive and set up log rotation. For example, servers with moderate activity, a daily rotation, you may see that file grow 1 megabyte for every 10,000 requests. We do have a tech note that discusses how to do log rotation. So if you search on Apache and log rotation, you should be able to locate that. Moving on to the error log in slide number 6. The error log is really a great place to look to see when the web server is experiencing a problem. The error log is going to be identified by the error log directive that you have in your configuration file. You can control that in different virtual hosts. So if you want one for port 80 and one for port 443, you can control that by having multiple error log directives to point to different files. Now, this file is going to grow as well, but it's not going to grow at the fast rate as the access log, but you can set up rotation for that as well if you want. There is a log level directive, and that's going to basically control how much information is written to the error log. When you come to the support center, it's common for us to request log level debug. By default, the log level is error. Moving on to slide 7. This is an example of an entry that will be shown when using the predefined common log format directive. You'll notice that not all parameters are showing a result, and that's why you see those as dashes in the log. But typically, the contents of interest are the URI request and the HTTP response codes. These are being represented by the %R and %S parameters that are included on the log format directive. We're going to discuss these HTTP response codes later in the presentation. Now, when you're debugging a performance problem, we have two other directives, %T %T and %D, and those are uppercase. And you can include those in the log format, and they will actually show the response time. One is in microseconds, and one is in actual seconds. So you can, if it's a long-running task, you probably want to just go %T. You can also include constant data in the log format. So you could say time, space, %T, and then that in the access log, you'll see the word time followed by the amount of time it took to serve that request. Now, a complete list of log format parameters can be found at the Apache website. Just look under the directives documentation. Moving on to slide 8, let's talk a little bit about the web service topology. On this slide, we're showing a web server fronting a single application server. There's also a firewall shown between the web server and application server. What's not shown is on the other is any other network devices. For example, you could have a load balancer that's proxying the client request to the web server. And it's very important to understand that whatever is in front of the web server, you have to understand that their configuration can cause issues on the back-end web servers and application server. For example, a load balancer or a firewall could be timing out connections before the application server is able to complete the request. And that could result in a 500 response code seen in the web server logs and reported by your end users. It's recommended that web server administrators map out their topology and identify host names and IP addresses of each server in the environment so they have that information handily. For problem source identification, it helps to try multiple tests, each bypassing elements in the configuration. For example, if you have a failing request, you know, and your users are going through IHS, well, maybe you want to route that failing request directly to the application server to see if it's a problem on your back-end server or if it's something related to the web server in the plugin. The same technique can be followed to determine if the issue is with the load balancer. You know, can you bypass the load balancer and hit the web server directly? Moving on to slide 9, we're going to talk a little bit about security features provided with IHS. The default configuration IHS, that allows for directory browsing for resources managed by the web server, and this is typically viewed as a security exposure, and we get lots of PMRs from customers asking how to turn this feature off. The configuration provides an options directive, and with that, you can actually say minus indexes to remove that ability. Another request we're commonly seeing is the HTTP trace method. Customers want to know how to disable that. It's viewed typically as a vulnerability security issue. So we have with version 7, there's actually a directive that you can say trace enable off, so you can turn it off that easily. Now, you may have your web server set up that users that you're listening on both port 80 and port 443, but you want to make sure that those customers coming in on 80 are automatically routed to port 443. And we provide that ability through some directives in the configuration called rewrite cond and rewrite rule. And we have a tech note that actually shows how you can make those requests that come in on port 80 automatically be redirected to port 443. That's a common one that we're seeing. If you have weak encryption SSL connection, there's the SSL cipher spec directive. You can control that information. And we actually talk about more security considerations in that link that I provide on the slide. So that's a great reference point. Let's move on to slide 10. Because IHS is based on Apache, there's a lot of vulnerabilities that might affect Apache that could trigger vulnerabilities or security warnings in IHS. If you have a security scanning program, it's looking at the configuration and your Apache install, your IHS install, and it may be showing that there's a vulnerability that you need to be aware of. Some of these vulnerability scanners, they're only looking at the server version of Apache, and so they might not really apply to IHS. In fact, many of them don't apply for several reasons. Some of these are IHS has already provided an alternate implementation to that Apache feature, so we don't take advantage of what Apache was doing. We have a different approach in our modules. It might be that IHS doesn't even provide that feature that Apache is providing that contains the vulnerability. Or IHS is based on a level of Apache which didn't have the vulnerability. That's another reason. And a final one might be that IHS already has fixed that vulnerability in a fix pack that you may have already installed. To see if that vulnerability is already included in IHS, there's another startup parameter. It's the dash uppercase V. And that'll show you all the vulnerabilities that are included within IHS. If IBM determines that a vulnerability does apply, then we're either going to APAR that or post a security flash to provide details on resolving the problem. Recent flashes that came out that you may have heard of is the Beast. There was another one affecting the byte range filter that was possibly causing a denial of service. When we have these flashes, we're actually going to post them on the IBM HTTP server support site. And what you can do, if you don't know where that website is, you can go to IBM.com and just search on IBM HTTP server. The product website will be the first hit that comes up. And going there, you can then click on support, and you'll get our support site. And in there, there's a flashes pane, and that will show you the current flashes that we have out. We're also going to put information about hot APARs that you might see that we think everybody needs to install. Moving on to slide 11, this is definitely what we see a lot of. And the most common requests we receive are help with some SSL and setting up IHS with secure sockets layer. Though it's a fairly easy process, I look at it as most customers would do. It's a do once and forget activity. So the current administrator may not have been there when it was first set up, or they just had forgotten the steps that they did when they did. Since it is dealing with security, it's deemed critical to get working, and any downtime can have major impact on the business, and thus that's why we commonly see PMRs come in and saying, hey, I need SSL assistance. So it's a good idea for web administrators to have a basic understanding of certificates and the process they must follow to integrate them into IHS. One of the first decisions to decide is the type of certificate that you're going to be using. If the web server is going to be dealing with confidential data and you have access to the external internet, then it's really best to use certificates from third-party certificate authority. However, if your SSL connection is on a trusted network, you can save a lot of cost by creating your own self-signed certificates. And a good example of this is where you're working on a test system where you're developing web application, but you don't want to have the added cost of a third-party certificate. The personal certificate is going to have a private key used by the server to decrypt the information passed to it. For additional security, it's common for certificate authorities to require that the key store contain additional certificates, and these prerequisite certificates are stored in the key store signer section. So you might hear the word signer certificate versus personal certificate. The combination of the personal and signer certificates are commonly referred to as a chained certificate. Moving on to slide 12. When customers are requesting assistance with setting SSL, then the above tech note that was referenced on this slide is the first place we point them to. Here you'll be able to reference the data that is key to setting up SSL support. For example, you're going to have to make sure that GSKit has been properly installed. That typically has. This next step, the configuration directives that need to be included. That's the key one is what do I set in my config file? What directives are needed? After that, how do I create a certificate using iKeyman and the request? And then I receive that, after sending the request onto my CA, how do I receive that into the key store? And, in addition to this, what other additional considerations have to be performed in the config file? For example, how is IHS going to handle multiple hosts that each accept SSL requests? And the next slide is going to give that. Okay. Slide 13. If the web server is going to support multiple websites that all require SSL, then the virtual host stanza has to be defined using IP-based format instead of a name-based format. Okay, that's just a requirement. With name-based virtual hosting, the server relies on the client to report the host name as part of HTTP headers. Using this technique, many different hosts can share the same IP address. This technique will not work for SSL, and that's because SSL negotiation is done prior to the virtual host processing. So for SSL, it would just use the certificate and other SSL settings from the first virtual host that matches the IP address if you were using namebase. And that's why we require you to use the IP-based naming convention. The example here assumes you're enabling multiple websites to use SSL. If you look at it, you see all host names are registered in, well, they would have to be registered in DNS, and also you have to configure the IP addresses on a local network interface card. The key here, though, is you use this SSL server cert directive, and that's going to identify the personal certificate associated with that server name. Another option is to use SAN certificates. We have tech notes that talk about how to use SAN certificates with IHS. Moving on to slide 14, we're going to talk a little bit about the key management utility that's commonly known as iKeyMan. It provides a graphical user interface to work with key stores. We also have some command line interfaces, but we typically shy our customers away from that and suggest that they use iKeyMan. I know there's some Unix customers that have problems with X Windows requirement. However, you can use iKeyMan on any of the operating systems, so you could download the free version, run it on Windows, for example. The file that you're creating, the manipulating, is the key store. It's in CMS format, and that's a common format across operating systems. So you can actually move it from one system to another, and it's totally supported. iKeyMan, you'll notice, supports multiple formats of the key store. For IHS, we require the format to be CMS. However, if you have a key store, for example, in P12, you can actually use iKeyMan to convert it into a CMS format. Slide 15. It's really common for customers to report a runtime problem saying that they're getting a certificate validation error message. And this goes back to the chain certificates. You'll see that the CA is typically providing instructions that when you get their certificate, that it'll have the personal certificate, but you may overlook that there's also instructions that point to the necessary root and intermediate certificates that also have to be added to the key store. Common to overlook it. To determine the necessary signer certificates that compose the certificate chain, all you have to do is really just start with viewing your personal certificate, and there's two fields. There's an issue to and an issue by, and what you want to do is follow that chain such that you get to the point where the issued by is the same value as the issued to, and that'll be the top level in the chain. Sometimes you might not have those certificates in your key store. What you can then do is you can actually take your personal certificate, and if you're in Windows, you can view it. And in the Windows viewer, you'll find that there's a tab that will show you the chain, and that will let you know if your browser already has that missing certificate, and from there you can extract it and then add that to the signer section of your KDB. If you're unable to locate these signer certificates, then definitely you should be able to locate them at the CA website, and if you're unable there, you can either contact your CA or IBM and we can assist you further. Moving on to slide 16, I'm going to pass control over to Harold, and he's going to begin discussing the Webster plugin.
Okay, thank you, Jim. My name's Harold Fanning, and Jim was talking about the IHS web server component. We support that IHS component as a front end to a Webster application server. And to do that on slide 16, there's a Webster plugin that has to be separately installed on top of IHS. This runs as a plugin to the web server process and acts as an agent to pass the HTTP request on over to the Webster application server. It's configured. The configuration for that plugin is done at the app server console based on the applications that have been deployed and the mappings of those modules to the servers, like the application servers behind it and the web servers that will be front end to it. This will build the actual plugin.config XML file. Be careful of manually editing that file. A lot of people will get in there, manually edit it, and maybe fine-tune some of the routes and things that can be selected. But then if they have automatic propagation going on from the app server, next time a propagation happens, he may overlay some of the things that he had already edited. So that's one thing to be aware of there. We only support the IHS web server in front of the WebSphere application server, not in front of other application servers. And there's a plugin policy that states the plugin itself must be at or greater level of support code than the application server. As far as the actual plugin parameters that are configured through the admin console, they would be found when you link on that web server admin console. But we also have a great tech note if you get a chance to go look on where each one of those individual XML parameters might be within the admin console. Slide 17. Requests can come into the IHS web server, and the question is, who's going to handle that request? All right, it can be handled as a static data request at the IHS server itself, or it could be handed over to the plugin, and the plugin can look to see if it's a request that he's going to handle and send on up to the application server. So how does that happen? Well, IHS in his http.conf file, which is in the install directory /conf directory, will look in his file and see if there's ever been, when you install that plugin, he actually inserts a couple lines of code into the conf file, into the http.conf file. So IHS will get the request, perform perhaps a couple of directives that need to be performed before handing over the plugin, like a rewrite or something in that, like that, that has to be done beforehand. And then he'll look to see if that load module has been configured for the plugin. And that's the load module here in the slide. And if that plugin does exist, he then hands the request over to the plugin. The plugin will decide if that's a request that he's supposed to handle or not, based on the host name, the port, the actual URI that's been issued. And then if it's something that the plugin is supposed to handle, he goes back and tells IHS web server that this is something WebSphere is going to handle. Now, that's key right there, that step there, because a lot of times we will see a delay at that point in time, and it could be a plugin issue, but we've seen third-party modules that have also been configured in the conf file that can take control of the thread at that time, and if they happen to have a defect or a bug, we could see a big delay or time in that small, it should be a very quick time window that the plugin goes over to IHS and says, I'm going to handle this, give it back. If that doesn't come right back, then there's probably a third-party module or something that maybe has taken over the thread in that time, and it's something that needs to be investigated. But if that doesn't happen, if everything goes as planned, that IHS web server will come right back to the plugin and say, okay, go ahead and handle it. Now the plugin will hand it, will build that GET request or that POST request, whatever the request is. They'll build that request and add some proprietary headers to it, like $WS something something, that are just WebSphere headers, and that's how he builds it as an agent to the WebSphere application server and fires the request on up to the app server and waits for the application server to respond. If the application server cannot handle the request, he's going to come back to the plugin and with a status code and tell the plugin that he couldn't find the request. The plugin now will turn around and give it back to the web server, IHS, and IHS will try to handle a request as a static request. And you can usually tell whether that's going to work or not because of the entire path of the URI. If it's usually it's some kind of directory structure that IHS or the web server has never heard of or doesn't have permission to get to. And so he can only go try to serve that file from his static content, usually htdocs. And if that request isn't there, then finally we go back to the client with the 404 file not found. So that's what I want the slide here. So when the plugin is configured, we'll send it to the plugin first before we try to handle it as an IHS static file. So we go to the next slide. And I have a few trace entries here in the next slide, slide 18, that typically is one way you get started on looking for this kind of problem. The very first record that I put in this slide here is taken from the actual IHS access log. I apologize. I probably should have put a hyphen in between it. You notice the difference in the format. And this goes back to some of the format that Jim was talking about in log level, where you have the timestamp, the GET request, the URI, and the status code of 404. So you start with the access log in the web server, and you find out if he issued that 404 himself or he passed it on to the plugin. And, of course, my point of the presentation is to talk about the plugin. So I'm going to assume he's passed this on over to the plugin because I know my HTTP conf file has the plugin load mod configured. So the rest of these entries I take and I run over to my plugin log and look for the same request coming in. And I can do that based on the timestamp now because the plugin is configured as an agent to the web server. So I look for that timestamp and I look for that same GET request that came in, and I notice that he's going to make the find request on the host port and the URI, in this case the URI being the JIPNGv2.class file that he's trying to find. And I know he got a 404 error what he's going to do here is he's going to try to find a match on that class and that host and find a route if there's an existing route for it. So the next one entry that I put in there, and there's several entries in between. I didn't, for this presentation, I didn't include entire trace file. But basically, after he goes through all those URI hits and host name hits and things like that, you'll find an entry in there that says he found a match. And that means he found a match, he found a URI group, he found a path, he actually found a server in that cluster or that route that's okay to go to, that has a positive weight, and he's going to pick it and build the GET file and send it on up to the application server, which is what happened here. The GET went up with the special headers in it. Now, notice the last entry there just says that the application server sent back the 404 not found. So it wasn't that. It was a static content. It came into IHS. He gave it to the plugin. Plugin sent it to the app server, and the app server couldn't find that class file. Next slide, slide 19. So the point of this slide here, it may be obvious, but the point here is there's always a status code returned, whether it's a positive qualified success or a failure. So the first three categories, the ones, the twos, and the threes, are all actually qualified successes, and those are just normal HTTP status codes for informational messages, a successful completion, or some kind of redirect or rewrite type response to the request. And the last two categories, the 400s and 500s, are the actual error codes in the status codes. So I gave you an example of the 404 where IHS is, the logic might be, think where IHS says, is this a static request? And if it's an IHS static, if there is no plugin, then he will be the one that has to go find that request in his htdoc static file, and he will then return the 404 or the 200 success. If there is a plugin, he's going to take it, the plugin, like we just said, and build the GET request, send it on up to, I want it to do three steps. If IHS is static, there's no plugin, then he's the one responsible for serving the file, and he'll be the one returning the 404. If IHS gives it off to the plugin's configured, but the plugin fails to find a match, it's not a URI that the app server has put into the XML file, then the plugin will reject the file with the 404, and then IHS will do his thing to see if he can serve it statically. But then the final flow is the one we just talked about, where IHS says the plugin is configured, gives it to the plugin gets a match in the URI, sends it on up to the application server, and the application server sends back either the 200 successful or the 404 not found. And the 500 errors, the 500s and 503s are fairly common errors. Those errors you see a lot when the server is either gone down for some reason, lost the connection to the server, or he's just not responding in a timely fashion. So we have some timers. We'll talk about in the next slide about how long we want to wait for an app server before we decide that he's no longer responsive. Next slide, slide 20. Moving on to different types of problems you might have in IHS. There's hangs and dock hang problems are quite common. In the IHS Diag, we have a tool called the Gather Hang Doc, and I just wanted to lay out that the Gather Hang Doc, what that does, you basically kick it off with a Java command, and the syntax is taken straight out of the IHS Diag recommendations in the website for IHS Diag. But what that does is it'll actually run a snapshot of the threads and things that are running in the process for IHS, for all the processes of IHS. And it'll run a snapshot, wait 60 seconds, run a second snapshot, wait 30 more seconds, and then finally run a third snapshot. So there's a picture of three different intervals over a 90-second interval. And the reason that's useful for a hang situation, you'll look into that doc and find out if there's any particular threads that haven't budged. If they haven't budged in 90 seconds, there's a pretty good chance they're hung up and they're a place to be focused on. Also, you'll see that if that thread is somebody else, like a third-party module that's taken over on our thread, you'll see them on the thread as well and be able to identify that third-party module. You can also issue the gather hang doc for individual process IDs and addresses as well. That takes that as a parameter. The second tool there is the mod MPM stats. And this tool is useful in tracing. When you set up MPM stats, you can do intervals on how often to log the entries from the MPM stats. And it tells the status or task that the current set of IHS threads are in the middle of. It'll also tell you if you're getting to a threshold, if you're hitting a threshold of max threads, or you've actually run out of threads. But if things are running normally, you'll get several MPM stats entries in the logs that report the eight possible states of those threads. And they could be in any of the following tasks at that moment. They could be ready, waiting for work. They could be busy, performing some kind of work. They could be in read. They could be in write. They could be in keep alive. They could be doing logging. They could be running out the DNS lookup to get a connection. And they could be actually processing a closing request, waiting for the entire session to actually be closed. The next tool is NetStatAN, which Jim talked about a little bit. And that's something you might want to do on the OS and the network to make sure that your IHS is listening to the ports that you think he's configured to listen to. And if you don't see the listens that you have configured in your httpd.com file, then you have to find out why those ports did not open for IHS to be listening to. And finally, I'm embarrassed that I didn't realize Jim had this in his part of the presentation, but I did break it out that it's a good idea to find out for long-running requests to use that %D or the %T, and then maybe precede it, like Jim said, with some sort of searchable string like T-I-M-E, time, colon, %T. The %T gives you the amount of time that the response took in seconds, and the %D is the amount of time in microseconds. And you would basically look for some kind of long-running request based on a lot of seconds or a very big number for microseconds. I mean, a lot of times these requests are going to be less than a second anyway, so the microsecond is a good measurement. Let me just interject one thing here, too. With the reason this %T, %D might be useful is IHS, when he logs the request into the access log, he actually will log that request at the time of completion, but he logs it using the timestamp when the request was made. And the distinction there is if you're looking at an access log and you see things that get out of sequence, that's an indication that that's a long-running request if you didn't have your %D or %T set up. In other words, it was issued at a timestamp prior to when it shows up in the actual access log. So if you see things that get out of sequence, that's indicating of a long-running request. The next slide, the load balancer, because you could have – this is a plug-in issue that comes up over and over again about saying that the plug-in is not really balancing things equitably or not. The load balancing function is entirely in the plug-in itself, not part of the IHS web server. But the plug-in will – load balance across servers within the same cluster. The plugin cannot load balance across clusters, but as long as the servers are in the same clusters, they'll load balance. We have a stats level, log level trace that's a good thing to turn on if you suspect the load balancing is not successful or not equitable. And then you could look into that stats and find out how many new requests are going, how many affinity requests, and I'll talk about that in a minute. multi-threaded. If you have multiple threads started in your IHS server, the plugin on each one of those threads do not have any shared information between them, so they'll all be running their own load balance algorithms. If you have Affinity, Affinity can affect load balancing, and Affinity is set up by the app server. You'll assign a JSession cookie ID, come back from the app server. It can be either a cluster, a clone ID, or a partition table, depending on how the Affinity is set up at the app server, whether he's using mem-to-mem or not. And if you're not sure, you could always look for the $WS special header called PT, which is for partition table. The reason I mention that is because Affinity can come up, and then the stats records themselves, it may look like one of the servers is getting hit harder than one of the other servers, backend servers, but in fact he's handling a bunch of Affinity requests, and all those Affinity requests are going to be routed to the same server. So this last entry I put in here with a log level of stats is to show you that he dumps out the Affinity requests as well as the total requests. So to parse that last request, if you were looking for an Affinity issue, what you would actually do is subtract the Affinity request off the total request, or, you know, 47 minus 31, and then you'd find out that there was actually only 16 new sessions routed to the server, even though that server may be doing a lot of work based on your Affinity request. And if you want to take, there is a parameter that was added later on in our, I'm not exactly sure what time frame, but there was an ignore Affinity request added to the plugin that could be set to ignore Affinity request equals false, so that you it will still decrement the weight even for an Affinity request, so that you can show that that server is being loaded and balance the load more equitably that way. And there's a great tech note, another Westie, that I recommend that was written purely for the plugin point of view. You know, this is part of an IHS pitch as well as a plugin, but the plugin itself has a Westie called Demystifying the IBM Web Server Plugin. It's a Westie that explains in detail how the load balancing works within the plugin. Next slide, slide 22. So these are some of the timers that are involved in deciding whether the server should be marked offline or not, or whether it should be used in the balancing algorithm. And they're kind of connect timeout is if you have to bring up a connection, and how long should you wait for that connection to complete before you decide that the server is just not going to complete the connection. Server I/O timeout is if he takes too long to respond. So that's a if the server gets in trouble but hasn't killed the connection, he may take too long to respond, and you may want to mark him down and move on to the next server. Retry interval is how often do you want to retry that server before you mark it down. Moving on to slide 23. We also get a lot of problems with the questions about the how to administer the IHS web server through the WebSphere application server console. So this chart here is talking about the three different flavors that you might have when you install your web server. Actually, when you install the plugin for the web server, when you install the plugin, it'll ask you a certain amount of questions so that it can determine if you have a managed node, an unmanaged node, or a co-located server. And as he finds out those answers to those questions, he builds this config, and then the XXX there is for the actual host name, server name, plugin.bat file, so that you can take that bat file over to the WebSphere admin console from the plugin configuration, plugin install at the web server, and then define him to be the right of these three, right kind of these three kinds of IHS web server nodes. So a managed node is a federated node under the deployment manager, and in order to have IHS running as a managed node, you would actually have to have the node agent running as well on that node. And these are all different interfaces that the admin console learns in order to talk to the IHS web server. An unmanaged node is, in order for the admin console, the WebSphere application server admin console to talk to it, the admin agent must actually be running. IHS administration server must actually be running for the console to talk to it. And then a co-located server is just sort of a hybrid between the two, where he knows that he doesn't have to waste any packet tracing or anything like that to make the same request, because he knows it's a co-located server. Going on to slide 24. So hopefully, in summary, this presentation gives you some idea of the administration of IHS and the plugin that goes between the IHS and acts as an agent over to the WebSphere application server. And here's a few additional links to the IHS web server. So go to slide 25. Slide 25 is where we provide several links for the sites, provide the valuable online resources for the WebSphere products. And at this point, I think we can return control back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Harold and Jim, for a great presentation. Jackie, why don't we open the lines up for questions right now?
Peter Nguyen, your line is open.
I have a question for Jim. Where will you find that Windows version of iKeyman?
The Windows version, it's actually shipped as part of IHS, so if you go to the download section from the IHS, if you search on IBM HTTP server download from the IBM.com search panel, you'll see that you can download IHS and install that on Windows, and that will install the iKeyman utility.
Our next question comes from Pradeep. Your line is open.
Hey, I'm Pradeep. I have a question in plugin section of IHS. See, enable load module for plugin, and if you provide the plugin configuration file, then does the IHS route to the app server through plugin each time, even for the static request?
Yes. The plugin always goes first because the IHS actually doesn't know.
But it might cache it.
In that case, like, more time is wasted even for the static content, right?
I believe that's true. Yes.
Right, but there can be some caching as well. So we have an ESI cache. So if you have static content, it probably would be pulled from there.
Okay. Thanks.
Our next question comes from Ed Italia. Your line is open.
If one of the backend application server is down, IHS will mark it down and doesn't redirect any requests to it. I think it does some kind of heartbeat to identify when it's up. Will there be any overhead / delay on the incoming request when one of the application server is in the pool is down? So, in short...
Right. What we try first is we check the connections. If we can get a connection to that server, then we will actually send the request to the app server, and then the delay is going to be the server I/O timeout. When that request times out, the plugin is then going to determine if it needs to mark down the server. And if it has a negative timeout value, it will go ahead and mark it down. Okay. If it doesn't, then it doesn't get marked down. But so there is some delay, but once it's marked down, it's not going to try it until the retry cycle. So there's a retry rate in the plugin log, typically at 60 seconds.
Okay.
So that it won't be brought into the pool until after that 60-second time period.
Got it. Thanks.
Our next question comes from Kiti. Your line is open.
So we have a Cisco device in front of our web server that's doing an IP-based routing. And our web server is basically, I think, it does a round robin algorithm, right? So is there any implication if we have IP-based routing and round robin algorithm for the backend application server in the web server?
Is there any what? No, those two load balancing schemes or algorithms don't know about each other. So the load balancer is spraying between the web servers, and the plugin is spraying between the app servers and the back end. So two different things. Now, I'm not sure I understood what the question was. I'm sorry.
Okay, so what our friend and the Cisco devices keep on doing an IP-based routing, and it sticks to one server, correct? And
one web server, though.
Yeah, one web server, though.
Right.
So that web server has a clustered application server, and it has a round-robin algorithm, correct?
Okay.
So is there any way to change, basically, on the WebSphere plugin to do a different kind of algorithm apart from round-robin so that it has a stickiness?
Well, stickiness is defined by the back-end app server. Stickiness is defined when you actually deploy the application and map the application. That's session affinity.
Oh, that's okay.
Right, but there is another algorithm for actual spraying load balancing. There's random. There's a random type of plugin that supports a random load balancer. But I don't think that's what your question is. Your question is, how do you guarantee affinity? And affinity is configured at the app server. And he'll assign that JSession cookie ID. And once the IHS sees the cookie ID, then you'll make sure you go to the same server every time, the server with that clone ID.
Okay, thanks.
The next question is from Daniel. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. I think my question was answered. I was had the same question about the static request that gets sent first to via the plugin to the app server, but is really handled from the HTTP server.
Well, keep in mind the plugin is installed. I'm sorry to cut you off, but the plugin is installed at the web server, right? Not the app server. So,
right.
So IHS, it's true. IHS will give every request over to the plugin. But the plugin does not send every request up to the app server. He only sends the ones up to the app server that he has a match for in his URI or hostname or whatever. So there has to be a match configured.
Okay.
So if your static content doesn't match any of the URI requests in the plugin XML file, it'll go right back to IHS.
Okay. So even if that's cached, I think you mentioned the ESI, was it, cache?
Right.
That's still, the request still gets sent to the plugin initially.
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, the plugin's actually going to find it in the ESI cache. It'll check that first before it sends it out to that server.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you.
And we have no further questions.
Thank you, Jackie. We are going to conclude the presentation at this point in time.